Looks like there's been a bump in big item spending.
So how's manufacturing doing in this recovery?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. This is the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Friday, September 24th. General Motors won't be quite so big when it returns to the stock market. And all the business news of the week in a Marketplace Minute. But first, we learned this morning business spending on a lot of manufactured goods rose sharply last month. Here's Chief Economist Chris Lowe at FTN Financial. He joins us every Friday from New York. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
So this monthly durable goods report was overall negative, weighed down by fewer airplane and car orders. But if you disregard that volatile stuff, it was good news?
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of those weird reports where you've got a minus sign in front of it and we all like it anyway. And that's mostly because aircraft orders were down, but they were up really big last month, and they're still up 11.5% year on year. And meantime, we're seeing strength in stuff like computers, electronics, and then also in primary and fabricated metals, which actually is the fastest growing sector this year so far.
Computers, electronics, metals. How does all this fit in with our hopes for an economic comeback in this country?
Well, I tell you, when you look across the U.S. state by state at unemployment rates, what you see is the closest to full employment is states that produce stuff, commodities, agricultural metals, and oil, for example. There's sort of a green belt from the Dakotas down to Texas, and that's precisely where we're seeing the strength here. It's one area where in the U.S. we're very competitive on the world stage.
Okay, interesting. Good to hear this morning. Chief Economist Chris Lowe at FTN Financial. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The issue of education reform is having its moment in the spotlight. Today, the much-hyped documentary Waiting for Superman opens in New York and L.A. Oprah is spending another hour on the topic today. And next week, NBC is hosting a big education summit. So what gives? From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott gives us the scoop.
At a press conference this week, the head of NBC News, Steve Capus, explained why the network is devoting a week of programming and events to education.
At the end of the day, the media, all of us, don't give education nearly the coverage that it deserves.
Or maybe didn't. Next month, the Reverend Al Sharpton launches a new TV show about education. A new reality show, School Pride, debuts on NBC. It's a sort of extreme makeover for schools. But will advertisers line up to pay for all this coverage? Media analyst Gary Arlen says they might.
American corporations, who are obviously the sponsors of any kind of programming, are really concerned about education because they can't find qualified workers.
And they're not above hitching their wagons to a hot issue. This week, the Conference Board, a business group, announced it's putting out a discussion guide for companies inspired by Waiting for Superman. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Rising world food prices are the topic of an emergency UN meeting being held today in Rome. The aim? Restore stability in the food markets and avoid riots. The BBC's Duncan Kennedy reports.
Russian harvests hit by drought, flooding in Pakistan and China, water shortages in Brazil. All big food-producing nations and all facing problems. And that means prices are going up. Take the cost of buckwheat in Russia, for example. It's risen by 11% this month alone. Elsewhere, meat and sugar prices have hit a 20-year high. There have already been riots in Mozambique over the price rises. Rob Subaraman from Nomura Bank says there'll be more rises in food prices as people get better off.
In these developing economies, there's a growing appetite to have higher calorie intake, wanting more meat, more fruit, more milk. And these things are very important.
The organisers of today's summit intend to share information and coordinate strategies to avoid a repeat of what happened 3 years ago, when there were riots in a number of countries as cereal and other prices soared. In Rome, I'm the BBC's Duncan Kennedy for Marketplace.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, September 24th. I'm Steve Chiatakis for the latest look at the markets. Check out the numbers section at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. There's a government probe in Britain looking at whether some of the country's biggest banks should be broken up. The Independent Banking Commission laid out some of its options in a report today. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London with what it all means. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
Breaking up big banks. That seems like a radical idea. Is this really on the table there?
Oh, it's certainly on the table. I mean, as in the US, there's been a lot of concern here about these big universal banks, which have both risky investment banking activities and retail banking. If the risky business goes bad, that threatens millions of retail depositors, and so the bank has to be bailed out. But whether breaking up these big universal banks is likely to happen here in the UK is another question. Analyst Michael Prest thinks not, since the US has already passed up on the chance to carry out the same reform.
The great bank breakup, which some people thought might happen, never occurred in the US. And therefore, it's unlikely, I think, to happen in the UK because there'd be enormous resistance in the City of London to running their banks in a completely different and potentially less profitable way from their competitors.
All right, Stephen. So if breaking up the big banks in the UK is not practical, what other reforms are we talking about?
A possible halfway house in which there's a firewall between the investment banking and the retail banking, so the retail arm is insulated. An absolutely key aim of this commission is to ensure that if things do go wrong in a big way again, it's the bank's shareholders and creditors that pick up the entire tab, not the taxpayers.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Congress is looking at using the tax code to keep companies from moving factories and jobs overseas. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports Democrats hope that idea appeals to voters concerned about unemployment.
The bill takes a carrot and stick approach. The carrot, giving companies a 2-year break from Social Security taxes for every U.S. employee they hire to replace a foreign worker. The stick, firms could no longer deduct the cost of relocating abroad, and companies couldn't put off paying taxes on foreign income. Would all that be enough to keep U.S. factories open? Economist Gus Fauché at Moody's Analytics is skeptical. He says foreign employees make up to 90% less than U.S. workers.
Those cost differentials are so large that any changes that they make through the tax code are going to be pretty minimal, and they really aren't going to be enough to sway business decisions.
And some big U.S. companies have moved their headquarters abroad, so they're not even subject to U.S. tax law. Catherine Mann is an economist at Brandeis University.
You know, Accenture, for example, is headquartered in Bermuda, and Halliburton, of course, in Dubai.
Mann says they're far from the reach of any tax legislation Congress can cook up. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Security experts are grappling with what could be a new and serious cyber attack. The Stuxnet computer worm attacks control systems at large sites such as industrial plants and power stations. From London, here's the BBC's John Bithrie.
The worm is a piece of malicious programming code. It was first detected in Belarus in June and has since been reported as interfering with software that controls industrial machinery in several countries. David M. from the computer security firm Kaspersky believes it's so advanced it could only have been developed with the support of a particular government.
The level of sophistication built into this threat, the motivation behind it in terms of disruption, suggests, you know, that maybe actually we're looking at not individual cyber criminals, but there may even be involvement of a particular nation state in wanting to do this kind of attack.
One respected cyber security expert from Germany has caused a stir by claiming the worm was developed to target a nuclear facility in Iran. Others say there isn't enough evidence to make that claim, but the revelation of the worm has reignited the debate about how technology could be used to attack vital computerized systems. In London, I'm the BBC's John Bithrie for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, September 24th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, just go to our website, marketplace.org. That feature is called The Numbers. It looks like when General Motors returns to the stock market this fall, it won't be as big a sale as first thought. Marketplace's Elisa Roth joins us from our New York bureau to talk about that. Hi, Elisa.
Good morning.
You know, for a while there, it sounded like this could be one of the biggest public offerings ever. What, not anymore?
Well, neither GM nor the Treasury Department are allowed to talk about this stuff right now because of securities regulation. So it's all a bit speculative. But early reports were that the IPO could be valued at something like $20 billion. The biggest was Visa's IPO back in 2008, which raised $19 billion. But now it's sounding like GM's is going to be more in the range of $8 to $10 billion. Among other things, everybody's worried about how an IPO is going to perform in this market. The two big issues for the Treasury Department, and by extension for us, as you said, are whether it can recoup its investment in GM and whether it can reduce its stake in the company to below 50%. That would make it a minority shareholder and let GM be a bit more of its own company again.
Right. So can that happen?
It's hard to know. The market for IPOs has been mixed, and the stock market generally has been mixed. There have been various calculations about how much the shares would have to sell for in order for the government to recoup its investment. The answer is about $134. And some auto analysts, at least, are pretty optimistic about the company. I think what people do agree is that it'll take years for the government to be free and clear of its ownership of GM.
That's our auto industry specialist, Elisa Roth. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We don't often give the price of commodities on the website or on this show, but Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports cotton closed above $1 a pound this week. That's its highest price in 15 years.
Cotton prices are up not because of anything happening here in the U.S., but because of bad weather in two of the largest cotton-producing countries, China and Pakistan.
When I get up in the morning, the first thing I do is look at Indian weather, China weather, then I look at U.S. weather.
Sharon Johnson is a cotton analyst with First Capital Group in Atlanta. She says back in November of 2008,
prices got below 40 cents as the worst of the recession hit, and here we are less than 2 years, and we've nearly tripled in price.
She says we're also seeing some of the highest demand ever for cotton, mostly from fast-growing developing countries. She calls it a cotton bubble that could soon burst, leaving farmers wondering what to plant.
A lot of producers may find it difficult to handle these kind of price swings and may be able to maintain a position.
One of them is Tim Lucky, a fourth-generation cotton farmer in Milan, Tennessee.
When my father was farming, the price of corn or cotton didn't fluctuate 4 or 5 cents a year. Now, cotton will fluctuate 3 cents a day.
Some blame speculators for the quick rise in price. Jeffrey Christian is managing director of the commodity research firm CPM Group. He says big investors have thrown a lot of money into cotton in recent years.
That's relatively easier in gold, but when you start getting into smaller markets like cotton or coffee or cocoa, it takes very little shift in investment money into these markets to drive the price sharply higher.
What does all this mean for consumers? Well, that $10 t-shirt may soon cost $12.
In the t-shirts and the underwear and the lower cost cotton garments, I believe you're already seeing the impact of higher cotton prices.
Perhaps it's time for polyester to make a comeback. Sharon Johnson says her husband might still have his old leisure suit in the back of his closet.
We might have to have it refitted just a bit.
I say go for it. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The St. Louis Arch is set to get a little facelift. A design jury has awarded the contract to a New York firm. Now, they're being asked to transform the arch into a world-class tourist destination. From station KWMU, Adam Allington reports.
When you talk about the arch, several things come up. First of all, it's breathtaking. Seriously, if you've never seen it up close, it's much taller than you'd think. A close second is, how do I get there?
You can see the arch, you're right beside the arch, but now what do? There's no parking down through here, so it's difficult, not very well guided.
Bob Forrester's in town from Indiana. He said he drove by the arch several times before finally finding the right exit. Ludwig Goppenhammer and his wife are from Colorado. They had yet another logistical problem.
I cannot find a bike rack anywhere. And there's even a bike trail down there. Yeah, I would think it would be a no-brainer. People would ride by and park by the arch.
But the larger issue that St. Louis is wrestling with is how to connect Eero Saarinen's iconic masterpiece to the rest of the city. For instance, if someone wants to walk the 4 blocks from the arch to Busch Stadium, they first have to cross over or under a very noisy Interstate 70. Michael Allen is a consultant with the St. Louis-based Preservation Research Office. He says fixing these outdated infrastructure issues is a growth business among architects and planners, particularly in river towns.
Every city that attempted urban renewal on the riverfront ended up with a large park and a giant interstate between the downtown core and that park. Louisville, Philadelphia, Cincinnati.
The consensus seems to be that I-70 will remain for now. However, Michael Van Valkenburg Associates, the landscape architect in charge of the project, does include plans for roofing over part of the freeway with a kind of green space lid. Other ideas for the 91 riverfront acres include a beer garden, an ice skating rink, and a bird sanctuary. St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay says the project has the potential to add millions to the regional economy.
As mayor, this is my number one economic development project. This is our top priority because it's more than just about the city. This is about the entire region.
The price tag for the project is still a moving target, though it's not expected to be cheap. Chicago's much smaller Millennium Park, completed in 2004, cost that city nearly $500 million. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
See the winning design, by the way, at marketplace.org. And finally, the whole week's business news in a Marketplace Minute.
The people who have the profession of declaring we're out of recession waited more than a year to sound the all clear. Tinker's dam, is that the expression? Blockbuster's finally going bust. After years of eating Netflix dust, they acknowledge their business model was wrong. Let's charge them a late fee for waiting so long. The FDA has begun to examine the worth of genetically modified salmon. Is it a cynical industry scam and a threat or a way to alleviate famine? And Colin Powell says, let's not grouse about illegal workers. They fix my house. I mean, houses of people other than me. That story is at marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great weekend. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.